Hey everyone, welcome back to Citywide Blackout, your home for music, movies, and more. I'm your host, Max Bowen. In her new book, Lemons in the Garden of Love, available May 11th from She Writes Press, Ames Sheldon looks at her ancestor who helped found the Birth Control League of Massachusetts, now known as Planned Parenthood. She talks about what it was like to explore her family history and how she adjusted it for her characters, Cassie Lyman and Kate Easton.
My next guest is the author of the soon-to-be-released book, Lemons in the Garden of Love. It will be released on May 11th through She Writes Press. I'm talking to author Ames Sheldon. Ames, welcome to the show. It is great to have you here.
Thank you, Max. I'm delighted to be here. I love Boston. I live in Minnesota, but I lived in Boston for two summers. I have lots of family and friends in the area, and I come visit every year. All three of my historical novels actually have something to do with Boston. And the new one, Lemons in the Garden of Love, has everything to do with Massachusetts.
All right. Well, I lived in Boston for 8 years, so I am always happy to talk to a former Boston cat. So let's dive right into the story behind this book. I'm going to give everyone a quick run through as to the plot. So it's 1977, and Cassie Lyman is working to find a topic for her doctoral dissertation. And then she finds this basic treasure trove of suffrage cartoons, diaries, and letters at Smith College belonging to Kate Easton. She's the founder of the Birth Control League of Massachusetts and a close relative, which she had no idea about. And Cassie looks to find the story behind Kate, why they're related, how they're related, what the story is, and why she never knew. So, I know that this also has a close personal connection to you, Ames, because your ancestor was the co-founder of the Birth Control League, which is now known as Planned Parenthood. So, that's a complicated story. Why'd you choose it for your new book?
Well, that's a good question, Max. I had a dream many years ago when I first learned about my ancestor, Blanche Ames Ames, co-founder of the Birth Control League of Massachusetts. I had a dream in which she told me to tell her story. She told me to write her story. And I never met her. I didn't know her. How can I write the story of somebody I don't know? So that made me work hard, think hard. It led me to do a lot of research. Kind of along a path that's parallel to Cassie's in my novel, research at Smith and at Radcliffe, at the Schlesinger Library, and other places. I also had to use a great deal of imagination to try and, you know, feel my way into who this character might be. I thought that the best way to present her would be through her diary. So Kate's diary is what I made up. But it's based on real events. But as I say, it's also very much imagined. I didn't have a diary of my great grand aunt to work with. I had letters that she had written and letters that she had received. So I had some stuff to work with. But really, it was an act of imagination. And inspiration. I mean, she inspired this book. I would not have written it if I hadn't had that dream about her.
So how close is your distant relative to Kate Easton?
Well, she's quite close in some ways, and yet she's quite different in others. The real Blanche Ames was not only a co-founder of the Birth Control League of Massachusetts, but she also was a talented artist. She was a botanical illustrator. She illustrated her husband's orchids, did scientific drawings of his orchids. He was a world expert on orchids. She did portrait painting. She had four children. She was also an inventor. I mean, she was a very complicated, interesting woman. Kate, in the novel, shares some of her qualities. She, too, is a suffrage cartoonist. She founds the Birth Control League of Massachusetts, but Kate doesn't have children, for example. Kate is not an inventor. I needed to really focus Kate on what was driving her. I couldn't kind of get my arms around a plot for my actual great grand aunt. So to make a plot with a lot of drive, I created Kate with some things that she really wanted and was going for that help explain why she does what she does in her life.
And if this isn't too much of a spoiler, why the secrecy? How does she not know that Kate is her distant relative?
Well, partly it has to do with her mother, who is not interested in history. So her mother never told her about this. But what's interesting is that she learns that her mother and her grandmother were very much involved in Planned Parenthood, but they just had never told her about that. You know, Cassie is 24 years old. She hasn't started asking questions much of her family until this story, until she starts learning about Blanche. And then she wants to know a lot more about, Kate, the character. And there are some things about Kate's story that the family didn't want to talk about. It was embarrassing to them. It was something that they didn't want to talk about. So I'm not going to say what that is because, well, I don't know. I think I shouldn't.
So if you want to know, folks, you got to go read the book. It's out just a little bit. You're going to love it. Let's talk about Cassie Lyman's character. Now, Kate is more or less a parallel to your ancestor. Does
That's
Cassie
right.
share a lot with you?
Some. So Cassie is struggling with her marriage. She is a graduate student in women's history, which I was. She has a very kind of dominating mother, which I have. but a wonderful mother, too, who, you know, taught her many things. So her mother is very supportive of her, but in certain ways. So yes, Cassie's story does have some parallels with mine, but thank goodness that was 30 years ago, or actually 40 years ago. So the great thing about historical fiction is it never gets old. You know, it's always relevant because it doesn't get outdated. It's current.
Mm-hmm. Now, this being historical fiction, I imagine the research was a big part of this. And I am a huge, huge history nerd. I love this stuff. Of course, everyone knows about Planned Parenthood, but the Birth Control League of Massachusetts, never heard about them before, had no idea that they even existed. Give us a quick rundown as to what this organization did.
The Birth Control League of Massachusetts was founded in 1916, and it was in response to an event. There was a man named Allison Van Cleek, who was passing out birth control information at a factory in Boston in 1916 to the women who were coming out of the factory, the workers. And he is arrested on the spot because birth control information is illegal. It's been illegal since the late 19th century. So he's a defense committee gets organized around him to defend him. And so Kate is involved in that. They defend him. They end up organizing themselves into the Birth Control League of Massachusetts. They become very public. I mean, there's a lot of newspaper coverage of them. They are reviled in the papers. These are women who, you know, prefer a poodle to a baby. I know it's amazing. Anyway, so finally, he is indicted, and in 1917, and Kate is so frustrated that she's an artist, she ends up carving a wooden penis and going out on Commonwealth Avenue to demonstrate how to use a condom. I mean, she wants to get this information out there. And, you know, she was an upper class woman. To be behaving that way was not typical for her friends. Did not. Well, she, of course, had some friends as part of the birth control league. She was the president of the birth control league for 19 years. In the 30s, birth control was still illegal in Massachusetts. The Roman Catholic Church is powerful in the state. In the 1930s, the Birth Control League of Massachusetts founded some birth control clinics, and they ended up being very good, very popular. And they ran for about 5 years until the police shut them down. And they, you know, the workers there also were, they were convicted of breaking the law. So when the Birth Control League of Massachusetts changed its name to Planned Parenthood by the 50s, the Planned Parenthood League of Massachusetts was sending women who needed birth control to the Planned Parenthood in Providence, Rhode Island. 40% of the women served in Providence were actually residents of Massachusetts, which is kind of ironic. The first oral contraceptive pill was developed illegally and secretly in Worcester, Massachusetts, in a lab on the outskirts of Worcester by Dr. Gregory Pincus and Dr. John Rock. Massachusetts finally, in 1966, changed its birth control laws to allow married women to have birth control, but not unmarried women. So it wasn't until 1972 when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Massachusetts' birth control laws, making birth control available to all women, not just married women. Massachusetts was the last state in the country to legalize birth control. The last state in the country.
Wow.
That's, I didn't even realize that when I started this.
And Massachusetts is seen as such like a progressive, like liberal state. That's ironic as hell.
Now, I know.
It seemed like you weren't reading off like a note card. You knew this stuff. So how much research did you have to do to get to a point where you felt comfortable writing the book?
Well, I did a lot of research. I went to Smith 3 different times and had, you know, material copied that I could walk away with, reading it and trying to digest it. I wrote a number of different drafts of this book. I tried to get it published and did not succeed. Finally, I put it in a drawer. But when Donald Trump was inaugurated in January of 2017, I decided it was time to bring this manuscript back out and to rework it and to get it published. That's my contribution, if you will, to the fight for reproductive freedom.
And I find it ridiculous that that fight still goes on, that everything that group dealt with when it first got started, with the organizers being arrested, with the places being shut down, Planned Parenthood still deals with that today, with places being bombed, with people trying to enact laws to defund them or simply outlaw abortions entirely, which I think is pure insanity. The timing, I think, is very fitting to get this book back out there, definitely. What do you think it adds to the conversation of reproductive rights?
Well, I hope that it will help educate particularly younger women about the fact that we must not take our reproductive freedom for granted. It's easy to forget what life was like when birth control was not accessible. Without birth control, women have no control over their lives, over the direction they want to take in their lives, over whether they have children, how many children, when. Reproductive rights, as you referenced, are still being contested across the country. Some legislatures are looking to ban abortions at 6 weeks. That's a point at which many women don't even know that they're pregnant yet. So, I mean, that's just crazy. And then Trump's naming of Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court seems to have energized those who would overturn Roe v. Wade, which is very scary. One of the things that Kate says in the novel is, why don't these men mind their own business? Come on, let women decide about how to handle their own bodies. Please.
Happy to do so. Happy to do so.
Thank you, Max.
Yeah, as you can probably tell, I am very much pro-choice. When it comes to delivering the message, how do you avoid making the book too political and making it more about the story?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think that's probably why I ended up focusing or having Cassie be actually the protagonist. So the focus is really more on her than on Kate, and the arc of her story of what's happening in her marriage. She's, you know, at the wedding of her pregnant sister, what happens with their family, how she moves forward in her career as a historian of women. That ends up being more of the narrative arc. She keeps leaving the wedding, for example, to read diary entries. So we still get a lot of Kate, but Cassie's story is really maybe more of the focus. However, there's such great details about Kate. Kate made illegal diaphragms in her home using darning rings and liquid latex. That's actually true of my great-grand-aunt. And family members who are no longer living told me a few years ago how stinky it was in the bedroom where those things hung on lines drying. So I love some of those stories. She invented spermicides and sent Margaret Sanger, you know, recipes for spermicides, trying to get birth control out there, you know, sub rosa.
Now, you mentioned that you have tried to get this published before. It didn't work. What were some of the reasons why people rejected you?
You know, that's a good question. They don't always tell you why they say no. The first place I sent it was the Feminist Press, who at the time were publishing some current fiction, Rita Mae Brown, for example. Maybe it was too political. Maybe there wasn't enough plot at the time, you know, in that very first draft. It certainly has a lot more drive than it did in its first incarnation. The last time I sent it out before I put it in the drawer, I sent it to Seal Press in Seattle. And their response was, you know, really, we publish murder mysteries, even though, I mean, we really like this book, but we don't publish just plain historical fiction. Why don't you send it to the Feminist Press? Well, okay, been there, done that. It's time to go in the drawer. So
how did She Writes Press come on to your radar?
Well, that's a good question. I was looking for a publisher actually for my previous novel, Don't Put the Boats Away, which also takes place in Massachusetts, a bunch of it. I don't know. I mean, I'd sent it to the University of Minnesota Press because some of it takes place in Minnesota. That was the case with Lemons in the Garden of Love as well. It was, you know, it was being turned down. Often they don't even tell you why, just, you know, they wish you good luck and whatever. So, She Writes Press publishes just books by women, and they are a hybrid press. So what that means is that the author has to help fund the publication. On the other hand, they go through a very detailed editorial process. They don't accept everybody. It's not a vanity press. They also have a relationship with Ingram Publisher Services, which means that there are sales reps who are out representing She Writes Press titles to librarians and retail locations and so on. So that was very appealing to me. The first novel I wrote was published by a local publisher in Minnesota, and they didn't really have any distribution or marketing capability. So I learned about the limits of that. Even though it was an award-winning book, I mean, both of the earlier books won more awards.
I am familiar with your other books, the Women's History Sources, and then you switched over to fiction with Eleanor's Wars, and then Don't Put the Boats Away. What makes a strong female character, especially where your books are not actiony. They're not, you know, murder mysteries. They're not like, you know, like beat 'em up books.
Well, that's an interesting question, Max. Well, what makes a strong, I think a strong female character has a sense of what she wants. What makes her interesting is that she's going to encounter difficulties, things to get in the way of her achieving her goals. So I think having some self-doubt to me is interesting in a character. You know, I don't want a perfect character. In the beginning, I want a character who grows over time over the narrative, who learns things and becomes more thoughtful, maybe, and makes some changes in her life. I was lucky to grow up in a family of very strong women. And so I had lots of role models, lots of examples, Blanche Ames being one of them. You know, what's interesting, there is one woman who wrote a biography of Blanche Ames. She said that if Blanche had been a man, there would have been 5 biographies about her. She was such an interesting, complex character doing so many different things. But books about women, especially biographies, you know, they tend to be about, you know, very famous women or not, or they don't exist.
True. Very true. Why not just do a biography? Why make a historical fiction?
Well, I thought about doing a biography of Blanche Ames. And you can imagine her name caught my eye when I first learned about her being Ames Sheldon. I thought about it. And I talked to some editors at one at a historical society press, one at a university press, you know, what about a biography about Blanche? Now, this was years ago. This was 20 years ago. And I was told it would not sell enough copies for them to be willing to take it on. So I didn't. Actually, one woman did finally write a biography of Blanche. And it was published maybe just about 10 years ago. It was called Mrs. Ames, Dear Mrs. Ames. Anyway, I could give you the title, but it's called My Dear Mrs. Ames, A Study of Suffragist Cartoonist Blanche Ames Ames by Ann Biller Clark. And it's published by a series, Feminist Literary Studies, writing about women. So, but that was only pretty recently, Peter Lang Publishing.
So you're told it would never sell, and then someone else does exact thing a little while later.
Right. Yes. Exactly. Irony. Some years later. But I love historical fiction. I mean, I love to read it. I love to write it. It's a lot more fun to me. The thing about historical fiction is I do a lot of research and learn a lot of telling details, which I really enjoy. But if there's something, if I come up against something where I don't know or I can't find out the answer, I can skip it. I don't need to include it. Whereas I think if I wrote a nonfiction biography, I would feel the need to somehow really get that piece of information nailed. I love writing historical fiction. I love having characters who talk to me in my mind when I'm driving, you know, when I'm really deep in a book. I just really love the process of writing and hearing what comes up. And often when they're talking to me in my mind, they surprise me. And sometimes they wake me up in the middle of the night with thoughts and suggestions. That's so much fun.
Any historical fiction writers that are like your top favorites or maybe inspire you as a writer yourself?
Well, there are a number of them. I really enjoy Ann Patchett. Actually, starting with Doris Lessing, wrote historical fiction. I really, really enjoy a local Minnesota author, Louise Erdrich. Hers are often historical, so... Yes. I also love to read mysteries for the plot, for the, you know, movement.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about your background, because I love the diversity of your like life story. You worked in the legal department of a chemical company. You were a journalist at 2 papers. You were an office manager for a startup auto salvage yard and then a grant writer for a number of nonprofits, including the Sierra Club, the Minnesota Historical Society. I'm sure there's a lot more to it. How did you get into writing novels, though? How did this become your thing?
Well, Max, you've really done your research well. Yeah, I have had kind of an interesting path. I knew when I was 9 that I wanted to be a writer. I read Stuart Little. I just loved Stuart Little. Decided I wanted to be a writer, too. So I've been writing my whole life. And many of my jobs actually had to do with writing as well. So in the legal department of the chemical company, I had to write documents and memos. When I worked at the University of Minnesota, I worked on a couple of projects as an author and an editor, the really big one being Women's History Sources, a big, massive reference book about primary sources for women's history. After that, I moved into fundraising and grant writing. So I'm still writing, as a grant writer. I was always writing fiction on the side, early in the morning for a couple hours before my daughter got up. But it wasn't until I retired that I was really able to focus on finishing these novels and getting them published, which is why I have 3 books in 5 years, which is kind of fast in a way. But I've been working on, especially Lemons in the Garden of Love off and on for decades.
Given the time that you put into this particular book, was it hard to give it to the publisher to say, okay, no more tweaks, no more changes, it's done, it's ready for the world?
Not really. I'm relieved. I'm excited to have it finally get out there. I wrote the last chapter the day that Joe Biden was inaugurated. I mean, that just seemed really kind of perfect. Now, granted, we'd been tweaking the text for months. For a few months, the copy editing and so on. But that just seemed to be kind of a perfect ending. Off it goes into the universe.
Exactly. And at the time of this recording, it's only about 3 weeks away from that universe from being sent out. So you have gone through release days before. When that day comes, do you get nervous or excited?
Excited. I mean, I'm excited now, too. It's different doing a release when we're still in a pandemic. I'm not going to have a reading at in a bookstore on the day it comes out. There will be some Zoom presentations, some radio shows. But it looks like the Boston Book Festival will be live this fall in mid-October. And so I hope to be there for that. And it's really fun to be able to talk with people face to face, interact with them, hear their stories, hear what they have to say about mm-hmm. the book or anything else for that matter.
Yeah. I love the Boston Book Festival. I've gone there a couple times, and hearing that it's going to be happening this year makes me very, very excited. So I'm sure you and I will cross paths at some point.
Absolutely. I'll be at the She Writes Press table, or maybe there'll be more than one table. We were quite crowded 2 years ago.
That's a good problem to have.
It is a good problem to have.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask about your female leads, but I imagine with these characters, there are certain kinds of tropes or cliches to avoid. How do you do this? How do you create the characters without kind of falling back on some of the more tried and true characteristics?
Well, that's an interesting question, too. I don't say a lot about what my characters look like, and more wanting their personalities to show through what they say and what they do. So there's that. I should also point out that in Eleanor's Wars, and actually in Don't Put the Boats Away as well, there is also a male co-protagonist. And it was very fun to write him. He's a little, effeminate in that he's not athletic. I kind of like actually not going with the cliches. He's not athletic. He's a musician. He's not a domineering kind of a personality. he's kind of shy, etc. So that's those are my guys. And he ends up becoming a physician after trying to make a living as a jazz musician, which doesn't work out too well. anyway, so women, yes.
Now, I imagine like any good writer, although this book is done, it's about to be released, you probably have a bunch more ideas up in your head. What's next for you?
Well, I'm thinking about a story. I'm thinking about a book of linked stories. We'll see if this happens. I'm thinking I have a fertility stone that I have loaned to a number of women over the years who were having trouble getting pregnant. And it's worked every single time with every single woman. And each of them have, you know, their own story about the troubles they were having and when and what their life was like and so on. So I'm thinking I might do a book of those stories. And in a way, that would be kind of an interesting counterpoint to Lemons in the Garden of Love, which includes some people who don't have babies.
I think it's a great idea. I really like that concept.
Good. Great. I'm glad, Max. Thank you. Well, we'll see. It's an engaging idea to me.
Definitely. Now, your first book, Women's History Sources, this was, of course, a nonfiction book. This was like an informational book. And then you published Eleanor's Wars, your first fiction book. Was it hard for you to pivot from one genre to the other?
No, I mean, fiction is what I really love to both read and write. And I use a lot of imagination, I think, when I write. And, you know, writing as a journalist or writing the Women's History Sources Survey, you know, that's just, it's factual. It's kind of easy. Whereas the fiction is much more compelling to me because it's more unknown. It's more challenging. I get to use my imagination.
Absolutely. I also want to ask about female characters in the here and now. You know, we've just gotten through Trump, and certainly that was a time. We'll just say that was a time.
Sure was.
Why do we need more strong female leads? What role can they serve in 2021?
Well, I think it's really important to have strong women role models for everybody. I mean, for our daughters, for our children. You know, historically, men have been at the center of what people write about, what people talk about, what people think about, who are the politicians, who are the leaders, who are the generals. To have women finally moving into important roles, maybe even sort of breaking the glass ceiling, I think is really wonderful. It makes for a much fuller sense of humanity, of what's possible for women, what's possible for all of us.
And I like that your characters are, they're not the typical like female characters. They're their own people who bring, I think, in my opinion, kind of a lot more to the table. Are there more out there? Or is this sort of a rarity?
Well, I mean, I think they're everywhere. They're the people you know and the people that, you know, you can read about in some books. It's true that in a lot of books, the women are maybe more powerful. But I don't know. I find the women I write about are people that I consider friends. And I guess they're like my friends in some ways. Excellent. So I think there are a lot of women out there. They're the women you know. They're your friend. I mean, how many famous ass kickers are in your life? I mean, maybe some.
That's a good point. All right. Well, Ames, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate this. And for the folks at home, Lemons in the Garden of Love, available on May 11th in print and ebook format through She Writes Press. You can find all the information on how to get the book on amessheldon.com. AMESSheldon.com. And Ames, thank you again.
Thank you so much, Max. I really appreciate your time.
This is Angelina Singer, author of the Upper World series, and you're listening to Citywide Blackout, the best podcast for independent artists.
All right, folks, that brings this episode to a close. You can follow the show on Facebook under Citywide Blackout and Twitter and Instagram under Citywide Max. Listen to the show on Podbean, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Amazon Music, and every Saturday at 10 p.m. on Boston Free Radio. As always, keep those ears open.